how did the Democrats come to abandon working people, the middle class of this country? And a related point, why is it that they failed to respond to what is the greatest issue of our time?
This week on KPR Presents, journalist and historian Thomas Frank takes on inequality and the Democratic Party. I'm Kay McIntyre. When Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, many political analysts and pundits were shocked. Hillary Clinton had been ahead in most polls, and many predicted an easy win for her in the 2016 election. One person who might have seen this coming was Thomas Frank. Frank is the best-selling author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? In that book, he criticized the Republican Party and the rise of social conservatism. Frank's latest book is Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People? In this book, Frank turns his attention to the Democratic Party and how it has failed the middle class. Listen, Liberal is now available in paperback. Thomas Frank will be in Kansas City this week on book tour. He's speaking at the Kansas City Public Library in downtown Kansas City, Missouri at 6:30 Thursday evening, April 6th. Frank is a native of Kansas City and a graduate of the University of Kansas. Today's broadcast is an encore presentation of his June 2016 talk at Lawrence's Liberty Hall prior to the 2016 election. He starts out recalling his time at KU and specifically a night at Liberty Hall.
30 years ago, I came to a show here, and I'll be damned if I can remember who it was. I remember where I sat. Right there. But I cannot for the life. Who did I come here to see in 1985 or 1986? Who was it? Was it Run, Westy, Run? Was it Husker Du? It might have been. It might have been Husker Du. I just for the life of me, I cannot remember. But that's what 30 years does for you. And so back then I wrote about cool things like music and art and blunting the cutting edge. And now I write about politics. And it's a degraded form, writing about politics. But it's what our nation values. And so, you want to get an idea across, this is the only way to do it. So I write about politics now, and you all know that I wrote a book about conservatives here in Kansas a couple of years ago, and I've spent a lot of time writing about conservatives, and about, in particular, about the way that the Republican Party ropes in working class people with all these, different varieties of fake populism that they're so fantastic at inventing. And today, though, I mean, we're basically watching the rise of the greatest fake populist of all time, right? Seriously, right? Donald Trump, right? This guy is like Huey Long minus the compassion. You know what I mean? And so as we watch this take place, I want to talk about something that I mentioned that, well, there was a whole chapter about it in What's the Matter with Kansas, but I didn't really go into it in detail back then, and it was this, that a good helping of the blame for the right-wing backlash that we're living with, that a good helping of the blame for this has to go to Democrats, that the degree to which Republicans have won these people over is the same degree to which Democrats have abandoned them. Yeah. And so that's why I think this is the year to ask whatever happened to the party of the people. And I mean that question in two important ways. First of all, how did the Democrats come to abandon working people, the middle class of this country? And a related point, why is it that they failed to respond to what is the greatest issue of our time? And what issue do I mean? What am I talking about when I say that? Well, thank you. You guys have read it already. Awesome. That's exactly right. President Obama said it himself, right? It's the defining challenge of our time. And he's right when he says that. And when he says it's the defining challenge of our time, that is a sweeping statement, but you think about it for more than a few seconds and you realize it isn't anywhere near sweeping enough, okay? Inequality. I don't like this word because it seems it makes it seem very technical. It makes it seem like it's just an economic problem we can solve with a twist of the knobs back in DC or something like that. But it's not. It's greater than that. Inequality is the whole gigantic question of how we are going to live together. And it's not an adequate word for it. But what does it mean? It's the shorthand that we've chosen, so let's use it. What does it mean? Inequality is the word that we use when we want to describe all the things that have gone to make the lives of the rich so much more delicious year on year for the last three decades, ever since Ferris Bueller came out, and even before that, of course. And also, at the same time, for all the different things that have gone to make the lives of working people so wretched and so precarious. So inequality is visible in the rising cost of healthcare and college, in the turn your cell phones off, in the cell phones that interrupt our... No, I'm just kidding. Inequality is visible in the coronation of Wall Street and the slow blighting of so much of the rest of the country. You catch a glimpse of inequality every time you hear about somebody that had to declare bankruptcy because one of their kids got sick. Or when you read about the lobbying industry that runs Washington, D.C. these days. Or the requirement, I guess it's like in the Constitution now or something, that our candidates either have to be billionaires' favorites or billionaires themselves. So inequality is about the way speculators and even criminals got a helping hand from Uncle Sam while the Vietnam vet down the street from you lost his house. Inequality is the reason that some people find such incredible significance in the, you know, ceiling height of an entrance foyer or the hop content of a beer, while other people are never going to believe in anything again. Inequality is a euphemism for the Appalachification of our world. And I know it, that it's the Republicans who have the primary responsibility for this plutocracy that we live in now. I know that. I've written many books on this. These are the guys that launched our nation on this long era of tax cutting and wage suppressing, and they made a religion out of the market, and they fought so ferociously to open our politics to the influence of money at every level. And you know that story here in Kansas. But listen, just blaming the Republicans one more time and turning the old TV set back to MSNBC, folks, it is not good enough. Not any longer. Because the things that I am describing are, you know, they represent a failure of the Democratic Party as well. Okay? Think about it. Defending the great middle class society, it's a cliche. But that's who they were. That's who the Democratic Party was. That was their traditional mission back in the day. And once upon a time, Democratic Party leaders would have taken one look at what's going on with our country right now and would have known immediately what to do. These were guys that had, there's a lot of things wrong with these guys. Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, John F. Kennedy. Yeah, they did a lot of things wrong. But one thing they were really, really, really good at doing was protecting the middle class society. That's what these guys were all about. I mean, shared prosperity was the Democratic Party's highest aim, defending this middle class world. And this is something they never tired of talking about and boasting about. And I mean, it's true that to this day, Democrats are still the politicians that pledge to raise the minimum wage and the taxes of the rich. But when it comes to tackling that defining challenge of our time, however, many of our modern Democratic leaders falter. Yeah, they know it. They know that inequality is rampant and inequality is awful, and they cry great big tears about it. But they can't find the conviction or the imagination to do what is necessary to reverse it. And instead, they offer the same high-minded policy platitudes that they've been offering since the days of Ferris Bueller. They tell us, right? They tell us there's nothing anybody can do about technology or globalization, right? These are the forces of God, right? The hand of the Almighty reaching down to intervene in human affairs. Globalization. And so the Democrats promise us charter schools and more job training. And they'll shovel out the student loans, right? They'll do that. But other than that, folks, they got nothing. Now, let's start with the issue of the Wall Street bailouts back in 2008, 2009. I think this is still the great sort of historical inflection point of this young century that we're living in. This is the moment when our country could easily have changed course. In fact, we elected a man, we thought that's exactly what we're doing, right? Hope, change. But our leaders chose not to. Think about what it was like back then in 2008. President Obama was elected on a massive wave of hope and enthusiasm, and then proceeded to continue the policies of the Bush administration, at least as regards to Wall Street, essentially unchanged for a couple of years. None of the big banks got put into receivership. None of the bailouts got unwound. No elite bankers were ever prosecuted. And so Obama and his Democrats refused to change course when every sign was telling them that they should turn, when it would have been good policy for the country to turn, to do something about the Wall Street banks, when it would have been overwhelmingly popular to turn. In fact, the country fully expected him to turn. And when I say the country, I mean including the Wall Street bankers themselves. Remember, these guys were so ashen-faced, they came to that meeting in the White House, they knew that they were being taken to the woodshed. They knew what was going to happen to them. Nothing happened, right? It would have been fully within the Democrats' power to steer the country in a different direction back then. Everybody was expecting them to do it. The president was elected to do it. It would have been healthful for the economy to do it. On this issue, there was no conflict between pragmatism and idealism. The idealistic thing was also the practical thing and the healthful thing and the popular thing. And still they chose not to do it. Now, I know that Democrats are the good guys in our, you know, truncated political system. They're the good guys, or rather the less bad guys. But it's not a coincidence that, you know, given what they did with the Wall Street banks, it's not a coincidence that all the economic gains of the recovery presided over by a Democratic president, that all the economic gains of the recovery went to the already wealthy. And this is not, or I should say not only, because sinister Republicans have thwarted the righteous liberal will. Look, I live in D.C. I know how Republicans play the game. They're really good at it. They are dedicated obstructionists. They've made a philosophy of this. But what we've got here is a straight-up Democratic failure. Barack Obama played this issue the way he did because that's how he wanted to play it. And we need to get our heads around that fact. Now, I call this a Democratic failure, but you know what the right word for it is. This is a betrayal. And the history of this betrayal goes back a long way. So when I was a kid growing up in Kansas City, you'd read the newspapers, and the Democratic Party was forever, you know, grappling with its identity, with these different factions in the party fighting with one another over, you know, who the Democrats were and what they stood for. And this went on all through the 1970s and the 1980s and up into the 1990s. And they fought with one another like cats and dogs. But there was always one thing that they agreed upon. And that was that the Democrats, you know, all these different factions, they agreed on one thing, disagreed on all sorts of other things, but they agreed on this, that the Democrats had to turn away from the legacy of the New Deal with its fixation on working class people. That's what had to end. And the man who brought closure to this long Democratic civil war, of course, was President Bill Clinton, who brought a new kind of Democratic administration to Washington. And if we want to understand what is happening to us today with a middle class in decline and inequality growing and wages going nowhere, all of these things, if we want to understand inequality, this is the period that we have to look back to. This is the period that we have to understand, okay? So Bill Clinton comes to Washington, and rather than paying homage to the sort of politics of Franklin Roosevelt, as all the preceding Democrats used to sort of ritualistically do, Clinton did the opposite. He did these sort of singular favors for Roosevelt's old enemies, for the banks, the radio networks, the power companies, the bosses, basically. He deregulated Wall Street. And when I say he deregulated Wall Street, it wasn't just one or two things. It was measure after measure after. It was a whole series of things that he undertook in his administration. He ensured that derivative securities would be traded without any kind of supervision. He deregulated radio and telecoms and basically put an end to the federal welfare system. Another thing that he did that a lot of people don't know about, that I've discovered nobody knows about this one, is that in 1997 he arrived at a secret deal with Newt Gingrich, then the Speaker of the House, to privatize Social Security. And they did this, they did all the negotiations in private. It's all out in the open now. You can read about it. People have written about this. Gingrich has, you know, given interviews about it. It really happened. They had a series of meetings. They agreed how they were going to do it. They were going to bring, you know, private accounts into the Social Security system, all that sort of thing. They agreed on what it would look like. They agreed on a timetable to do it. And Clinton even took the first step in getting the ball rolling on this. If you look at his State of the Union address in 1998, he says, we need to save Social Security first, which was his code phrase for privatize it. And you know how this ended? You know what happened? The next day, the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. And that was the end of it. So Monica Lewinsky saved Social Security. I'm serious. Seriously, I mean, she's kind of a hero if you think about it, right? She didn't mean it. She didn't mean to do it that way, but that's what happened. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly. Put her on the 20. So look, Bill Clinton's an interesting guy in all sorts of ways, but one of the things, he had this strategy when he was running for the presidency. He had this strategy as a candidate where he would go out of his way to insult or distance himself from some traditional Democratic constituency like labor or minorities, and thus assure the public that he was his own man, right? And there was a reasoning behind it, right? He could do whatever he wanted to these people because, remember the phrase? They have nowhere else to go, right? That was the great phrase of the Clinton era. He could say whatever he wanted to these people. The most famous example was Jesse Jackson. So Clinton arranged to insult Jackson to his face before the cameras of the nation. Remember this? It was called the Sister Soldier moment. And what's curious about all this is that eventually this sort of weird campaign tactic of insulting your supporters, this campaign tactic became for Clinton a full-blown philosophy of governance, right? Body slamming the very people that had just got you elected. The great example here is the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which, remember, was negotiated by George Bush Sr., but then Bush couldn't get it through Congress, because Congress, of course, at the time was controlled by, that's right, Democrats of the old school, and they were opposed to it. Organized labor was opposed to it. They fought it, you know, all the time, and he couldn't get it through. It took a Democrat to do that, and that was Bill Clinton, with, you know, an assist from his buddy Rahm Emanuel, current mayor of Chicago. But when Clinton got NAFTA passed, rammed it through Congress, think about this. He wasn't just insulting his friends in organized labor as he had done with Jesse Jackson. He wasn't just insulting these guys. He was conniving in their ruin. Okay? You know, he was assisting in the destruction of their economic power. He was doing his part to undermine his own party's greatest ally, to assure that henceforth, in any kind of dispute between management and labor, management would always have the upper hand, regardless of what the dispute is about, because management can now always say, we're going to move the plant to Mexico. They can make that threat now, and it's credible. And they do it all the time. They wheel this threat out in any kind of confrontation with labor, and they actually do it. They actually follow through on it from time to time. So in passing NAFTA, Clinton made the problems of working people materially worse, okay? And NAFTA is fascinating in all sorts of ways. This was the first of the big trade deals. There's a whole series of them all through the Clinton administration. They continued through the Bush administration. And there's one on the burner right now, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But what's fascinating about NAFTA, I mean, one of the many things that's fascinating about it is that it is as close to a straight-up class issue as we ever see in this country. And it gives us an idea of who our modern Democratic Party means to please, okay? So on the one hand, who's in favor of NAFTA? It's professionals and the wealthy. And who's opposed to it? Right, professionals, people with advanced degrees, and the wealthy. And the people opposed to it tend to be blue-collar workers, people with a high school diploma. So professionals were no doubt, you know, were very much impressed to learn that 283 economists had signed a statement saying that the treaty would, you know, boost employment in America, economic growth, increase exports, all that stuff. Paradoxically, or ironically, or however you want to put it, the predictions of the unlettered blue-collar workers were the ones that actually turned out to be true. They were closer in their predictions to what actually came to pass than were the rosy scenarios of those economists and the Rhodes Scholar who sat in the Oval Office. Now, another interesting thing about NAFTA is that Clinton's fans, Clinton's supporters, Clinton's admirers, regarded this as his finest hour. That's the phrase they would always use. NAFTA was his finest hour because he had stood up to organized labor. It was a brave act. And there was all of this sort of praise for Bill Clinton from Democrats for NAFTA. And there's a sort of version of this view. So when I was writing Listen Liberal, I didn't use any of the sort of Republican hate literature about Clinton. I stayed away from that stuff, and I focused and read only the sort of admiring books of, you know, about Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and that sort of thing. And one of these books came out in 1996. It's a biography of Bill Clinton written by the journalist Martin Walker. And he said, you know, Clinton has done a few things wrong, but that these failings were, and here's the quote, these failings were in the end balanced and even outweighed by his part in finally sinking the untenable old consensus of the New Deal and the crafting of a new one. Now, this is an admirer of Bill Clinton here that I'm talking about. This is a man that thinks he's a great president. And what's great about him? That he killed the New Deal consensus. Okay? That's his admirer speaking. And he set up a new consensus. Okay, so who are the heroes of this new consensus? What does this new consensus, what does it consist of? Well, the same Democratic thinkers who used to fight like cats and dogs, advising the party to abandon workers in the New Deal, these guys had the answer. What Democrats had to embrace, they said, was the emerging post-industrial knowledge economy. And the people that Democrats needed to identify with were the winners in this new economic order, the highly educated professionals who populated our innovative knowledge industries. And what do I mean by professionals? In addition, you know, you've got your traditional professionals like lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects, that sort of thing, but you also have now an enormous professional economy out there, people like math PhDs who write derivative securities, you know, biochemists who make prescription drugs, that kind of thing. Now, if you go back to the 1950s, professionals as a social class, as a cohort, were almost entirely Republican. They were one of the most Republican groups in America. By the 1990s, they had completely changed sides and were one of the most Democratic groups in America. And that's where they are today, Democrats. And that's, conversely, that's who the Democrats are. They are a party of the highly educated professional class. And they have other constituencies, of course. They talk about it all the time in their magazines. Minorities, women, the young. These are the other members of what they like to call the coalition of the ascendant. But professionals are always the ones who come first for the Democratic Party these days. These are the ones whose technocratic outlook always tends to prevail. And it's always their tastes and their manners that are celebrated by liberal newspapers. And you know what I mean when I say that. It is artisanal everything, right? And it is the sort of a particular professional way of looking at the world that is taken for granted by liberals as being obviously true. So what I'm saying is that professionals dominate liberalism in the Democratic Party in the same way that Ivy Leaguers dominate the Obama cabinet. And if you read a lot of Democratic Party literature, which I did, they have all of these flattering phrases for their favorite demographic, all of these, you know, wonderful sort of terms of endearment. They call these high-achieving professionals the wired workers who will inherit the future. They are a learning class. that truly gets the power of education. And I have to say here, a learning class. Don't you love that? It's like some people are in the working class, but other people are in the learning class. It's like, it's so awesome. They're supposed to be, and you know this one, you've heard this one before, a creative class that naturally rebels against fakeness and conformity. They're an innovation class that just can't stop coming up with awesome new stuff, right? And democratic leaders themselves are, of course, drawn almost exclusively from the ranks of this very same group. So it's not a coincidence that both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and for that matter, Hillary Clinton, were plucked from obscurity by prestigious universities. You think about Bill Clinton's life story, sort of fascinating life story, an archetypal life story of our time. He's a kid in Hot Springs, Arkansas. He goes off to Georgetown University. He becomes a Rhodes Scholar, Yale Law School, and the doors of the world, you know, open up for him. And Barack Obama, it's a very similar kind of life story. So the time that these people spend at these very fancy schools are what define them as individuals. And you think about their cabinet choices or their inner circle of advisors. It's all of these successful professionals whose worth was determined by their achievements at college or graduate school. So let me summarize what I'm saying here. The Democrats have invented this kind of, denatured Marxism, where this class are the heroes of history. These are the people that stand at the telos, right? The dialectic of history, and this is it, the professional class triumphant, right? So that's their theory of history. That's also the Democratic Party's number one constituency, and it's the group that the Democratic leaders themselves are always drawn from. Okay, so what I'm describing is a class party, but it's not the working class, okay? This shift of allegiance from the sort of traditional working class, middle class, to professionals. This shift is what explains so much that is frustrating about our modern day Democrats. This is what explains, to go back to the question that I started with, this is what explains this vexing question of Barack Obama and the Wall Street banks, okay? Let's go back to that. Why did the Obama team fail to do what needed to be done with the Wall Street banks? Why did they declare that Wall Street executives were going to be held to a different legal standard than ordinary criminals? And they did say that. The man who said it had to resign immediately, but he said it, okay? Why did this administration choose Wall Street over average people again and again and again? I mean, every time there was a decision to be made that would might benefit like middle-class homeowners or Wall Street. Every time there was a decision to be made, they went in that direction. Always chose Wall Street. Why? Because for the achievement-conscious people who fill the Obama administration, investment bankers are more than friends. These people are classmates. These people are their peers, right? The two groups are the same. So, you know, people, the administration and Wall Street, people go back and forth through that revolving door. One day they're at Citibank, the next day they're the Secretary of the Treasury, or they're running whatever, you know. They go back and forth through this revolving door. You know, first you're Obama's press secretary, and now you're at a hedge fund somewhere. There is no difference between the two groups. The Democrats of the kind I'm describing, of the leadership faction, Democrats look at Wall Street and they say, this is an industry that is filled with people of subtle minds and sophisticated jargon, and oh, they love that jargon, and this extraordinary innovativeness, right? They're plucking wealth from thin air, right? That's Wall Street. Those are exactly the sort of creative individuals the Democratic Party theory tells us we must honor and respect, right? They're making these financial instruments that are so admirably complex. By the way, anecdote. So when I was writing this book, one of the guys that I talked to is was a bank regulator back in the 80s, and he had a hand in prosecuting a great number of SNL executives during the last big financial meltdown. And he was telling me that in his day, the bank regulators, when they would see undue financial complexity, they would say, aha, zero in. That's fraud. They're up to something, okay? When the Obama people see financial complexity, you know what they say? Sophistication, right? They love that stuff, right? It's financial rocket science, as one member of the administration said. And by the way, he said that when he was explaining why they couldn't prosecute these guys. It's financial rocket science, man. Complexity. Nobody understands it. It's so creative. And it's exactly the same for Big Pharma. You know this, right? So innovative. You can't import generic pharmaceuticals or something like that. You can't hurt Pfizer. You have to protect these innovative companies. Oh, folks, mega dittos for Silicon Valley, right? An industry that can do no wrong in Democratic eyes. I mean, so lovable, so professional, so creative, that for this one industry, enforcement of our country's antitrust laws has basically been suspended, okay? As Secretary of State, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she used to travel the world proselytizing for something that she called internet freedom. And what she meant by that, and she was very open about this, many speeches on the subject, they're all on the State Department website, but don't read them there, read them here, okay? Listen, liberal. But she would go around the world proselytizing for internet freedom, and what she meant by that is that access to certain Silicon Valley servers, right, like Facebook and Google, that sort of thing, access to certain Silicon Valley servers was a basic human right. Okay? That was the foreign policy of your country, folks. So, what does a party of the professional class believe in? What does it look like? Well, the most important item on the list, number one item on the list, is meritocracy. Meritocracy, that's what they believe in. This conviction that the successful deserve their rewards and that the people who are on top are up there because they are the best. This is the first commandment of the professional class, okay? Now this is, meritocracy is wrong in about 100 different ways, but the only way we're gonna talk about it here is that this is like the worst way possible to take on the problem of inequality, okay? This is not a doctrine for mitigating inequality. This is a way of rationalizing inequality, right? The idea that everybody gets what they deserve and what they deserve is defined by how they did in school. This is a way of looking at this, you know, huge economic morass that we're in, the middle class coming apart, wages never going up, and they say, well, that's just because you didn't study hard enough. You didn't go to college. Or maybe you did go to college, but you went to the wrong college. Or maybe you went to the right college, but you didn't study the right subject. You didn't study STEM subjects. 5 years from now, it'll be like, you studied STEM subjects? What the? Of course your wages are going down, duh. Right? You know it. It's always a way of taking this, whatever the big economic problem is, and pushing it back down onto the individual. It's, inequality is not a failure of our economic system. It's a failure of you. So the idea that I'm getting at here is this, okay? There is no solidarity in a meritocracy. It's, the two ideas are exact opposites. Okay, in professional class leaders, the people at the top of the administration and the people in Wall Street, show this amazing respect for one another, right? For the people at the top, but they feel no sympathy for members of their own professional, for their own discipline, who happen to be lower down in the hierarchy. Think about the white-collar workplace. If any of you have experience with the white-collar workplace, when somebody gets fired, the other workers don't rally around him or her and say, we're going to go on strike, we're going to do something about this, we're going to confront the boss. This never happens. Everybody knows that it's always because you somehow deserved it. You didn't study hard enough or something like that. You screwed up in some way. Or I'll give you an example from my own life. I'm a member of this class, by the way, the class I'm describing. I went out and got a PhD at the University of Chicago, as Brad was saying. It was in history. And I finished up in 1994, went out on the job market, and I discovered, what a surprise, there were no tenure-track jobs anymore. There were, but there's like 10 of them for the entire country or something like that. There's very, very few anymore. Everybody was being pushed, and it wasn't just history, it was all the humanities, being pushed into being adjuncts. You know what this is? We're in Lawrence. You guys know what this is. You work your butt off, right? And you get paid next to nothing. It's unbelievable. It's like not what you signed up for. I got a PhD, you say. Too bad. And this is happening all across the humanities, and it still goes on to this day, and it's getting worse. And it's, you know, it's not just the humanities anymore. It's all across, you know, it's PhDs of every description. Now, the people at the top of these disciplines still had and still have a certain amount of power. How much sympathy do you think they feel for their adjuncts, for the students, their former students who are now toiling away as adjuncts? Do you know how much? Very, very, very little. There are some good professors here and there, but by and large, these disciplines don't give a damn, okay? That's meritocracy. There is no solidarity in a meritocracy. That life doesn't shower its blessings on people who can't make the grade isn't a shock or an injustice. This is the way things are supposed to be, they think. Okay. So this story that I'm telling in Listen Liberal, as you can see, is in some ways a happy and inspiring one. This is the... But think about it. I'm quite serious. Think about what I'm saying here. This is the gradual, this is the coming together of money and merit, of righteousness and success. This is the marriage of finance with political virtue, because virtue and righteousness are what being a liberal is all about these days. But in another sense, the transformation of the Democrats has been a disaster. Think about it this way. Left parties all over the world were founded in order to advance the fortunes of working people. That's why they exist, okay? But our left party here in America, and one of our two monopoly parties, let us never forget, our party has chosen over the last 30 years to turn its back on working people's concerns and make itself instead into the tribune of, you know, the enlightened professional class, a creative class that makes fine, innovative things like derivative securities and smartphone apps. And the working people that the party used to care about, the Democrats figured, had nowhere else to go, in the famous Clinton-era expression. Folks, they have found somewhere else to go. By abandoning these people, Democrats have made inevitable both the economic desolation of vast parts of the Midwest, as well as a populist backlash against liberalism that has been building slowly for decades. And 12 years ago, I wrote about it, what I saw here. I saw it out here. And today, folks, it is all over the country. It is everywhere. The backlash is everywhere. You know, screaming up out of the deindustrialized zones, you know, chanting its bizarre and ugly slogans. And you just think about the choice that that leaves us with this year. On the one hand, angry right-wing intolerance, and on the other, inequality forever. Folks, there has got to be a better way. Thank you very much.
You've just heard Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas? And Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People? Frank spoke June 15th, 2016 at Lawrence's Liberty Hall, sponsored by the Lawrence Public Library. He now takes questions from the audience.
Given the potential that automation has to destroy jobs on a massive scale over the next few years, and we all know about this, how is that going to play out politically? I think we know the answer. I mean, we've got one party that is convinced that it's your own damn fault because you didn't get, you know, the right degree or something like that, or you didn't go to college or something, and you need all what you really need is more student loans. I love that one, right? It's more student loans. That'll solve the problem. Right? Everybody just needs to get deeper and deeper in debt. By the way, the place I got my PhD was the University of Chicago. It now costs, I'm getting off on a tangent, but he can't stop me because his microphone doesn't work. It now, do you realize that it now costs 60 grand a year to go there? 60 grand. So if you were to go for 4 years, that's $250,000. Nobody can afford that. You know, this is a formula for disaster. Okay, so how, and then you get out, and of course, what are the jobs, right? You're gonna go work for TaskRabbit, right? What is left, right? We all can see this happening. There are jobs, they just don't pay very well. The unemployment is way down, but wages aren't going anywhere. We can all see what's happening. How is this going to play out politically? Well, we know what's going to happen this year. I mean, it's easy to see. Trump is there's no way that this guy is going to win. Wait. But so it would be ironic. And Hillary, you know, is status quo. So what's going to happen is 4 years from now, you're going to have the anger is going to be that much worse. The party of the professional class has shown it can't do anything about this problem. I mean, and there are things you can do about inequality. I mean, there are things you can do. It's not this insoluble problem from on high. It's not God reaching down to destroy the middle class. It is a political matter, and we can change it. But all the changes are off the table. So 4 years from now, you're going to see a new Trump movement. Trump's politics minus Trump. Trump minus Trump is actually, they could win. And you're going to see a new Bernie Sanders, hopefully. So look, it can go, yeah. So this thing can go. It can turn out well, or it can turn out really, really, really bad. And that's where we're going, I think. But it's a terrifying situation. I was telling you that story about being an adjunct, and I eventually started writing stories for a newspaper in Chicago, and I got paid better being a journalist than being an adjunct. So I'm like, the hell with this. I'm going to be a journalist because that's where the money's at. And now that's gone, right? And book publishing is quickly diminishing. I have friends who are musicians. Oh, Jesus. I have other friends who are family farmers. It's like you just look at the options. The world is coming apart, folks. And there is going to be some kind of explosion. There has to be. So, okay, and somebody up here, what did you shout? What did you shout? Say it again. What's the better way? What's the better way? Look, we're in Kansas. Populism, folks. This is a state, right. In the 19th century, when we know what the answer to this is. It's just off the table for us. In the 19th century, they didn't have political science, but if they had, there would be political scientists who were experts in third parties, because you had third parties all the time back then. And when the two major parties would refuse to address the issue of the day, whether it's inequality in the 1890s, or there's a lot of the same things that we're seeing now, rampant inequality, you know, on a scale that's far beyond what we're seeing today, or earlier, the slavery question, which the two parties would not deal with, that's when a third party rises up and makes the issue impossible to avoid. And you have the Republicans in the 1860s, and you have the populists in the 1890s. After populism died down, and that was Kansas, by the way. That was this place that did that, that put populism on the map. We had a populist governor, two populist senators, populist members of Congress, populist mayors, you know, right down the list. And after populism died down, it scared a lot of people. You know, they thought this is like Robespierre, and that's where this is, you know, they're going to come and chop our heads off. After it died down, in every state where you had populism, they made its techniques illegal. Right? So that third parties would never happen again. And that was basically the end of the sort of viable third party thing in this country. Well, we need that back. We're in a situation now where the two parties are refusing to deal with the big problem before us. We have to have some other alternative. And I like what Bernie Sanders did, but it's got to go farther. Okay, yes.
My question is about what you had to say about the bank bailout and Obama's handling of that. And of course, the public argument given by the Obama administration was that if the banks failed, the economy would crash and the middle class and the working class would suffer. So I'd be very interested to hear why you think that argument is wrong and what you think would have happened if they had let the banks fail.
Well, my problem with that, and I remember them saying that, right? It was all about confidence. You had to keep up confidence. There's all sorts of ways in between crashing the banks and letting them just go about their business and do what they were doing before. There's all sorts of other escalation steps that you can take in between those two extremes that they didn't even try. You can, for example, okay, so the Roosevelt administration, one of the things I looked up, this is in an earlier book of mine, the Roosevelt administration did bank bailouts. They inherited the policy from the Hoover administration, and it was, when Hoover did it, it was terrible. It was a terrible policy. They were doing exactly what we did this time around. They just gave the banks money, and the public was so mad. There was rampant cronyism. The bankers were basically helping themselves to the public, you know, the Treasury, this kind of thing. Roosevelt came in and completely changed the program. It was called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and his the man in charge of his bailout program was a, by the way, a populist banker from Texas. He hated Wall Street. And you know what he did? He would say, he would go to a bank and it's like, well, we don't like the way you manage this bank. We're firing all of you. All of the C-suite people, boom, gone. We're replacing you with these other people. They'd go to a city where the banks were obviously fraudulent. They'd put the banks out of business and they would, the federal government, our government, would start a new bank. This happened a number of times. There's all sorts of different things that they could do, measures that you can take in between, you know, and to just let them off the hook, not even prosecutions for obvious fraud. And when I say obvious, they called these things liar loans, for God's sakes. It's like everybody can see what they're doing. You know, these guys know what they're doing. And not even any prosecutions for this. Nobody gets fired. By the way, they fired the CEO of General Motors. They had no problem doing that. But none of these banks that are bailed out, oh no. You know, can't touch those guys. Have to treat them with kid gloves. They even, in the bailout of Detroit, they took an investment banker and put him in charge of that. You know, because that's right, that's who you trust, right? The investment bankers. So all I'm saying is that there's all of these different steps that you can take. And some of them were even suggested at the time. I remember Krugman saying they should put Citibank, they should break up Citibank as a test case. It's the biggest, it's the one that's most underwater. You know, Citibank is a, you know, it's a giant money pit and we're just dumping money into it. Go in there, restructure it, reorganize, you know, get rid of the management, break it up into like five different companies and start over again. By the way, this happens all the time in our country with smaller banks, putting them into receivership. It's not frightening, it's it happens all the time. I have no idea why, well, I do, I have a very good idea why the Obama people were very reluctant to do this. And I think it's the reasons that I described, because they feel a class solidarity with those people. There was, there's, by the way, tons of evidence for it in the book, but there was one that just came out in the newspaper the other day that was shocking to me. Jesse Eisinger, writing for ProPublica, and he got all the emails, there were SEC, Security Exchange Commission emails, about their non-prosecution of one of the companies, I think Goldman, but I'm not sure. You have to look at the Jesse Eisinger story. But basically, the executives at the Securities and Exchange Commission are writing back and forth to each other about why they're not prosecuting these guys. And one of them says, a high up official in the SEC says, come on, these are good guys, they made one mistake. One mistake, folks! 7 years later, we're still living with it. Does that answer your question?
So I recognize in many ways you're preaching to the choir with this book and your previous books, but one of the critiques that you made was that the Clinton administration took for granted many of the minority voters that were in place. And how does race factor into your critique?
So the Clinton administration is, you know, a lot of people look back on it as good times, because the last few years of the 90s were economically good times and wages went up. For real, you know. It was, the only time, really, in my entire life, I think. No, I was born in 65, so there were a bunch of good years in the 60s. But the only time in a lot of people's lives when wages, real wages, went up year after year, 97, 98, 99, it was, seems like good times. But when you go back and look at what Clinton actually did, it's dreadful, okay? So the 94 crime bill, you know, this is a monstrous piece of work. I'll tell you one detail from that nobody knows about. I mean, they know about it at the time. You can look it up on the internet. The stories are still there. This is 94, 95. The internet was just beginning, so a lot of the newspaper stories are easy. They're easy to find. So a year after the crime bill of 94 was passed, and obviously in 1994, and we all know what it did. Built prisons all over America, criminalized a whole bunch of things. You know, basically the intent was to throw all these low-level drug users into prison, increased the number of federal death penalties from 3 to 60. I mean, it did all these things. And one of the things that it did was it said, okay, the U.S. Sentencing Commission has to weigh in on the crack versus powder cocaine sentencing disparity. Do you guys know what this is? I'm getting into the weeds here, but there's a chance you guys know what this is. Yes, so powder cocaine, which is commonly used by members of the professional class, was punished at a certain rate, right? There was the sentencing for it was done at a certain rate. Penalties for using crack were 10 times as great.
100 times as great.
Yeah. But it's outrageous, right? So for the same amount, it was treated as though it were 100 times greater. And the bill said, okay, the Sentencing Commission should weigh in on this, and whatever they do becomes our sentencing practices here in America. So the Sentencing Commission goes off, does their study, and they come back and they say, this is racist and inherently unfair to punish crack at 100 times the rate of cocaine. You know, this is what is filling our prisons. This is what is causing mass incarceration. We hereby abolish it. Boom. Okay, by that time, the Republicans were in control of Congress, Newt Gingrich and the gang. And they said, and they passed a law reversing that decision. Are you all with me so far? So the Sentencing Commission says this sentencing disparity is abolished. Congress, led by the Republicans, says, no, we pass a law saying it's not. It goes back to what it was, 100 to 1, okay? Then it goes to Bill Clinton. If he had vetoed that, the sentencing disparity would have been abolished. Do you know what he did? He signed it. He signed that thing. He put his hand on it and signed it. This is a man that shook the hand of Nelson Mandela. It makes me like shake to think about it. I can't stand it. It's the Congressional Black Caucus implored him to veto it. The Million Man March was about that time. There were riots in every prison, prisons all over America when it became clear that he was going to sign this. He could have vetoed it and solved that problem. He signed it. A few years later, welfare reform. This is picking on the weakest members, the most vulnerable members of our society with welfare reform. You know what I'm talking about? Do you remember what welfare reform was? Just threw it over to the states. Now they're on the mercy of Sam Brownback, right? Awesome. Good move, Bill Clinton. So that's what I have to say about that. I'm sorry. I get really worked up about that. It pisses me off.
In the last year and a half, millions of Americans, including tens of thousands of those of us from the learning class from the Harvard of the Plains, have fought very, very hard for equality and solidarity for the one candidate we believed that was the true FDR-like New Deal Democrat. My simple question to you is, why didn't you help us out with the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Well, I don't live
here. We could have used your help.
I don't live here. Come on, you know that. And I'm a journalist. I'm not allowed to get involved in campaigns. But you don't think this is helping?
A little too late.
Yeah. No, I'm not allowed to have yard signs or anything. I'm like, you know, I can't give donations. I can't get involved. I did do an interview with Bernie Sanders, by the way, that you all might want to read. It's good. It was in Salon.com. It was in 2014, 15. Well, whatever, I forget. But it was a great interview because he talks about should he run as an independent or should he run as a Democrat? And he was arguing both sides. And it was fascinating, fascinating. A very interesting man. I really liked him. And I like that he wears that suit all the time.
So you obviously think that the problems our society is facing are systemic and widespread. That to me, it sounds like you're saying basically the foundation's rotten at this point.
Yeah, anyway, it's something like that, yeah.
So the foundation of the government is the Constitution, and I remember hearing about an interview Ruth Bader Ginsburg made a couple years ago where she said that if a new country were writing a constitution today, she wouldn't recommend they use our constitution to start. She would tell them to look at Canada or South Africa.
Really?
Yeah. So my question is, what do you think we need to redo the Constitution, maybe?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, do we redo it, or is it just a matter of interpretation? I mean, so many things, like, it's just a matter of interpretation. And I'm going to change the subject on you here. Watch how I do it.
You're very brilliant at it.
Interpretation. So the antitrust laws of this country, the Sherman Antitrust Act, is still on the books. We don't enforce it. It could be enforced tomorrow if Barack Obama chose to. It's not up to Congress. It's not up to the Republicans. It's up to him. He could instruct his attorney general to go back to the enforcement standards of, say, 1967, And he would go out, frankly, between you and me, he would go out of office a hero if he did that, if he started taking these guys on. People would love him. It's a matter of interpretation. He doesn't want to do it. And so they let it go. But there's all sorts of examples like that of things that we... another one. I learned this from a book by... what is her name? Zephyr Teachout. You guys ever heard of her? She ran for the governor of New York.
She's running for Congress in New York now.
Yes, that's right. She's running for Congress right now. But in addition to these things, she wrote an excellent book called Corruption in America. And it's a history of corruption. And I was fascinated because I tried to write a history of corruption once. The Wrecking Crew, right? About Jack, the adventures of Jack Abramoff and this kind of thing. But she goes all the way back to the beginning of the Republic, and the things she finds are incredible. Did you know lobbying was illegal in many states? Lobbying was a felony. It was in the It's like, it's crazy. But think about what they thought back then. They're like, wait a minute, you just sold your services to go and get a piece of legislation passed in Washington? How can that be legal? And so the Supreme Court was like, yeah, that can't be legal. That's crazy. You can't do that. And it was in the constitution of various states. Lobbying is a felony in like the state of California. There's all sorts of states, all gone or just interpreted differently now. So we have a different understanding of what lobbying is now. I'm thinking about this a lot because, do you guys ever read Politico magazine? Yeah. So I'm on their email listserv, and they have one that comes out every day talking about lobbyists, who got what account, how they're lobbying for this, you know, for this fighter plane or this sugary cereal or whatever, how they're, you know, and you know, all the jolly times that the lobbyists are having. Like, I saw so-and-so down at the bar at such-and-such. You know, by the way, Washington, D.C. is a city that doesn't have any of the problems that I've been describing. This is a very prosperous city. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going nowhere with this. I'll shut up now. Yeah.
We all know that this country is formed during the age of enlightenment. Are we entering into an age of endarkenment today?
Yes. Yeah, we are, folks. So this is, I remember in 1994... the cover of Baffler number 6. It has my essay, and the title is Dark Age. And it was my response to the dawning of the internet, that this great thing was happening, that this great, wonderful thing was happening, and it was going to be human enlightenment. And look at what has happened to us. We have a culture that worships enlightenment, that worships the professional class, that worships science and big data, you know, and number crunching. And creativity. And then look at the people that party elects or puts in office. Larry Summers. This is not creativity, folks. This is the opposite. Okay? This is going in reverse. Look at what happens to people that go out and get a PhD in any of the humanities. Look at what is happening to books in this country, to the culture of reading in this country. This is not an age of enlightenment. We're going in the other direction. And the worship that we profess for the creative, you know, which is always, you know what they mean by that. It's always just the CEO, right? It's always what they mean by that. But this, our worship of creativity and of science, it's just a tiny little veneer. It's a tiny little veneer over the rot, over what is happening to us. Thanks for coming, folks.
You've just heard Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas? And Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People?, which has just been released in paperback. Thomas Frank will be at the Kansas City Public Library this Thursday, April 6th. For more information, visit kclibrary.org. Today's program was recorded June 15th, 2016 at Lawrence's Liberty Hall, sponsored by the Lawrence Public Library. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. KPR Presents is only possible with the support of listeners like you. Pledge now at kpr.ku.edu. And thanks.